All the Rage with John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.
Hello, listeners. Welcome yet again to another edition of All the Rage right here on Trax FM. Thank you very much for listening and for your time. And as we say every week, as much solidarity and love and support we can send out to you around the world during these very, very difficult times. I want to begin. We're very fortunate to have another interview this week. But before we start that, I'd like to begin with a little bit of information from our good friends, the United Voices of the World. They are a trade union, predominantly London-based, but expanding out to the rest of the UK at the moment, who predominantly have membership of those in lower wage and heavy immigrant areas of work. So this week they announced another great victory. Security guards, porters and cleaners at the Ministry of Justice are voting for trade union recognition, 70% in favour from United Voices of the World. This marks the first time a non-TUC affiliated union has won a recognition deal in Whitehall, apparently. And this victory comes despite what UVW identified as shocking union busting that the union made several complaints about to the CAC. It also follows a recent victory for full sick pay for COVID-19 related sicknesses. And this is very pertinent as it's 2 months after the death of the MOJ cleaner Emmanuel Gomes. This victory gives them the guaranteed right to negotiate. UVW also alleged that the OCS offered workplace leaders inclined to vote in favour of recognition pay rises and condition that they transfer to other sites, as well as blocking other key union members from attending meetings for the purposes of discussing recognition. The union claims a contractor also refused to provide employees with face masks, which prevented meetings between the workers and the union from taking place, something which saw UVW lodge a formal complaint with the health and safety executive. UVW have pledged to continue the fight until the MOJ ends outsourcing and hires the workers directly on equal terms and conditions with civil servants. So as ever, United Voices of the World, you have the full support and solidarity of us here at All the Rage. Now, the main event for this week. We are delighted to have another interview, and I'm going to hand over right now. Please introduce yourself, interview.
Hi, I am Nirmala Rajasingham. I am a member of South Asia Solidarity Group, which campaigns in solidarity with struggles for social justice and democracy in the South Asian subcontinent. We have been around for over 20 years, and I have been for much of those years been an active member of South Asia Solidarity Group, or we call SASG. I also live in Harrow, and I am also active with Harrow Labour Left, and I am also a Labour Party member. I am a South Asian myself. I'm from Sri Lanka, came here as a refugee in the mid-80s, and we have been in our group, and many progressive South Asians have also been thinking about what the Black Lives Matter movement means to us. What does it say to us? How does it speak to us? And how do we think around the issues of building new forms of solidarity in the anti-racist movement in the UK? And the thing is, when I talk about this, we can see that the Black Lives Matter has caught the imagination of a very large number of people on the left. Of course, all of the Black community in the UK. It seems like it opens up a whole range of new opportunities for anti-racist organizing in this country. And so it is very exciting to see that happening. Having just come away from an election where the country elected a party and a prime minister who has made many overtly racist remarks, very perturbing for people like me. And however, so then we have this sort of a historic moment as such, but we know that it's not a moment and it's going to be a movement. So this is what I'm concerned about. This is what raises many questions for us. And first of all, I think before we talk about what can happen in the future. I really want to talk about what has happened in the near past, in the recent past, in the anti-racist movement. And I would say that for the past 10 years, things have been very dormant. We don't know whether austerity and the sort of, hideous privations piled upon people due to austerity have kind of made people simply resign to their fates and just become subdued. And that's one thing. The second thing is, in fact, the other indicator is, I'm thinking of the United Families and Friends campaign of many victims, many deaths in police custody. A large number of black people have died. And since the 90s, many of these families have campaigned doggedly, determinedly, but very much alone. So in the last 30 years, since the early 90s, these deaths have happened. And some years they have happened quite frequently. But none of them have had any justice. No one has been convicted of these crimes. And so you find these families fairly without much support, carrying on a lonely journey. And we have to look at why this has happened. These are the questions that I have. Particularly the UFFC has always struck me as a campaign. Now they have all the families have come together and have formed this United Families and Friends campaign. And they have had little support in the past. And now hopefully attention will turn upon them. And when you look at the kind of issue that they are struggling against, these are deaths in police custody, many of them young people, and you would imagine, you would think that something like this would be, headline news. It should be on the national agenda when you're talking about race in this country, racial injustice. You would imagine that this is a frontline burning issue. But it hasn't been for the past 30 years, and we have to try and understand why that has been, why that is so. So that's one thing, and that takes me back to kind of looking at events that events that happened in the 50s and 60s. For instance, when the first migrations of people from the Caribbean and the South Asian subcontinent, particularly from India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, when they first started coming to this country, invited by the government, they were brought here to fill the labor shortages in the post-war British economy. They were welcomed here. Some of them were British subjects still. They were subjects of the British Crown still, because those countries had not achieved independence yet. But many of them were welcomed here as from the Commonwealth. And when they came here to build and support the British economy by doing the most difficult jobs at the bottom of the working class hierarchy, many of them were not made to feel welcome, as we know, and there were many attacks on them, racist attacks as well. Housing was incredibly difficult. And even the trade union movement didn't welcome them, because they were seen as, the black and Asian workers were seen as people who had come to undercut the wages and jobs of the white workers in this country. And even when they were, there was a great reluctance to absorb them into the trade union movement. But when they were even like full union benefits, the trade union movement was reluctant to give them the full union benefits. Now, if that was the case, then there were these people, the workers who came from the Caribbean and the Indian subcontinent, were also, it appears as if they were working in different labor pools. And they were working in different places, different labor sites from the white workers. They were also in different places, the black Caribbean people and the South Asian subcontinental workers were working in different, for instance, many of the Indian workers were working in the northern mill towns. And the Caribbean workers were working in hospitals, on the railway, the underground, maybe construction industry, etc. So in a way, they are working class struggles for located in different places. They experienced a lot of racism in their workplaces. So they began to organize as workers. They began to organize for racial justice as well as for black workers. So it's very interesting because the trade union movement was not very welcoming. They couldn't get trade union membership in the early days. So no housing. It was very difficult to get housing for black workers. So therefore, they faced these multiple issues to do with their race and with their class. So it was both these kinds of oppression were intertwined, so to speak. So they organized, for instance, I think the Indian Workers Association began to grow in the 50s, 60s, and likewise amongst Caribbean workers. They organized separately, but there were many joint struggles as well as you know, workers of color, they joined together. And as their struggles became more insistent and they demanded more and more rights, they demanded access to the welfare state, to health, to education, the same rights as everybody else. The state had to respond. And the state responded with a plethora of legislation, the Race Relations Act, the Commission for Racial Equality, and following those two pieces of legislation, they also enacted racial equality councils, racial equality officers, and a range of NGOs that would implement and oversee all these, you know, race-related state-supported endeavors, ostensibly to minimize, ameliorate the ravages of racism on these populations. But before that, they also did something else. So these pieces of legislation were supposedly to give some kind of facilitation, some kind of empowerment to the black communities. But before that, they also passed significant immigration legislation. The first one was 1962, but the Immigration Act 1971, which is the sort of spine of all immigration legislation since then, you know, it has flowed from that. That legislation was brought in 1971. And these were about controlling further arrivals here, controlling their movement, controlling the number of people that can join here as family. So on the one side, they were controlling the immigrant populations through immigration legislation, which I think to this day is the front line of, you know, racial controls of racial communities. And the Racial Equality Council, the Race Relations Act were all kind of to placate the people of color, the various black populations here. When these groups began to organize and jointly organize and struggle, they all came under an umbrella movement of black resistance, or what is now called as political blackness. There were ethnic differences, but they also, because they had these class solidarities, the class solidarities brought them together as black workers. So they had this umbrella term under which they united. Having said that, once these new legislations, the state, when it enabled these legislations, and in particular with multiculturalism, what happens is differences between communities is emphasized. Multiculturalism is about emphasizing your roots and your cultural roots and your faith and the roots as far as your religion is concerned. So those became emphasized, and people began to organize, particularly along those lines. Particularly, there is some state dispensation for multiculturalism, for this project or that project, and, you know, for this kind of NGO to be set up to do this kind of thing, to do something to do with culture or faith. So instead of communities of class and black resistance along, you know, they became communities of culture and faith. So this, I think, changed the situation. So class solidarities, I think, after this began to erode a bit. So, because everybody sort of started disappearing into the rabbit hole of their own culture and their own community. And then there was a whole phenomenon of, you know, competition between different communities for NGO funding. And of course, there was competition between other, you know, white groups as well. So basically, for state funding. So with this, I think many theoreticians point out that as these class solidarities began to erode, where people came together as black people because of their class struggles, various class-related, their work-related issues, now it was beginning to erode because they were competing for the same thing. And, A. Sivanandan from the Institute of Race Relations, now no more with us, but, veteran activist writer and, had an amazing insight into these issues. He said a race industry evolved out of all these so-called enabling legislations. So the state does this. But of course, it's not a one-way street. It's not just the state dispensing all of this. And the communities are just sitting there, mutely receiving them. It's not that. It's the community also engages with the state. And what the community does is, and who on behalf of the communities engage with the state? So there are these new communities of culture, communities of faith, and the cultural religious leaders come to the fore, emerge to the fore. So those working class black leaders who fought against, street battles against racists, neo-Nazis or whoever, their influence kind of recedes. And new leaders who are essentially more conservative, I would say, because also they have to keep the state's dispensation going and they have to keep engaging with the state. And in a way, they have to participate in this race industry. And I know as a South Asian, I have seen this happening in our communities a lot. So as a result, then that takes over and class solidarity erode. So as a result, I think the anti-racist movement begins to erode a bit. We are no longer campaigning and fighting together, organizing together politically. These are no longer communities of political resistance against racism. So basically, I think that is what happened. And it happened, and the tragedy is that particularly African people of African descent in this country then start getting divided as Africans and as Afro-Caribbeans, and even amongst, and then of course people of African descent and people of South Asian descent become separated. And then within the South Asian communities there is of course Punjabis, Gujaratis, Bengalis and Kashmiris and Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, these are all different projects, these different groups which are vying with each other for state funding and state recognition. And there's an argument as to who should represent ethnic minorities. And as you can see, bureaucratically, the state also begins to change the nomenclature, how people are called, the different terms with which, the labeling. So this BME, the BAME, these are all bureaucratic terms devised by the state. And, for people like me who come from ex-colonies, this is nothing new because the same processes have happened in our countries during colonialism, how communities are counted and classified and separated and set apart and different dispensations are deployed according to the communities. And their engagement with the state is kind of, organized in such a way. Of course, very, very, very sort of the kind of, I would say, that sort of common sense term, phrase for this divide and rule, that the British used this, method of divide and rule in the colonies. Yes, I suppose it's true. But it is it's the state, the capitalist states, need to keep everyone controlled and in their place, to classify them, to categorize them, to keep them apart, to label them. And, you know, these names, the BAME, which I find it very difficult to say it. I know some people call it BAME, and I just find it a very strange name. BAME is a term given to us by the state, because that is how we are categorized in all these, tick boxing exercises that the state indulges in. So having said that, and so therefore, you know, something like the United Families and Friends campaign, it's outside the ambit of all this race industry that is going on. Because this is all also about representation, you know, who represents these communities is a big question. So as I told you, cultural leaders, religious leaders, the more amenable leaders came to the fore. And the same thing happens to political representation as well. What are the questions the various political parties ask as to how they are going to select the people, the leaders who they want to represent, say, for instance, Africans or Afro-Caribbeans or, you know, in a particular area for where I come from, you know, Harrow. There's a large, diverse, you know, community with a large number of South Asians, mainly Gujaratis and Tamils, Sri Lankan Tamils, but also we have Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, and Punjabis as well. And a much smaller number of people of African descent. So basically, how political parties determine who is to represent them is also a very interesting question. What is this kind of test that they apply? So these have become very problematic issues because I find that political parties see ethnic, see minority communities or people of color as vote banks. So if they choose the right community leader or religious faith or cultural leader, he will deliver the votes of that community. That's how it is seen. So in all these deliberations, I think racial injustice gets left out. It's not dealt with. So that is why, for instance, when you look at stop and search, I am told that the the disproportionate sentencing of black people in this country is even worse than in the US. I mean, that is really, really worrying. I mean, this is something that I have read recently during these Black Lives Matter protests. And that is shocking because that means that the criminal justice system is not working at all. We have a certain number of black and Asian MPs in parliament. And the criminal justice system has not been really, there have been attempts, the Scarman or the McPherson, but, you know, things have not moved on. And very naked, blatant, aggressive surveillance and control, are applied on minority communities. For instance, this gang warfare database for surveillance on black youth, or the PREVENT program to do surveillance on Muslim youth and children. It starts with children. I mean, the people talk about, you know, how punitive the system is. The highest number of school exclusions are in the Afro-Caribbean community. So, why is that? You know, this is really stark. And it also seems like it's the sharp end of this whole problem. And if that doesn't grab headlines, how are we going to view other more minor issues of racial injustice that are going on, where people's lives are at stake, where people die because of racial injustice or racial brutality? If that doesn't stir this country's conscience, then what about immigration? There's so many other issues that we can talk about. We have had these, NGOs, etc., racial justice related NGOs all set up. But when austerity came, the first projects to be shut down were those that dealt with black people and Asian people. They were the first to go. I work with domestic violence victims. And, you know, Asian women's refuges and the black women's refuges were the first to be shut down. Because now many other mainstream refugees have also faced the cuts. But so that is what happens. These NGOs, these dispensations can come and go. But the underneath, the issues of racial injustice, racial policing, racial profiling all remain undisturbed. So that is my question. So new questions have to be asked about why this anti-racist movement became dormant. What happened? How were people divided? How were people became ethnic minorities became vote banks? And why did the previous or the militant race and class struggles erode? These questions have to be asked if we are pondering the future of anti-racist organization in this country. I also want to talk about another issue, as a South Asian. If you're interested, I would like to talk about that as well.
Please do.
As you know, one of the things is that with multiculturalism and all these, this so-called, as Sivanandan says, the race industry process, I think communities got divided and all the difference became emphasized as opposed to what was common between us. I mean, in a way, we can also say this is true within working class solidarities as well. You know,
then
Absolutely. People got divided. So working class struggles also, joint working class struggles also became very, very difficult. So now, there are these antipathies between different ethnic groups, which have been kind of fostered by bureaucratic processes here in the UK. But there is also a kind of a historic dimension to the kind of antipathy between South Asians in this country and people of African descent, because I think our linking together and forging links and solidarities together is crucial to the long-term success of the anti-racist movement in this country. And so when I look at it, basically, I just want to go back into colonial history of the subcontinent, particularly India, because, you know, pre-independence, the whole terrain of India, what is now India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, they were all one territory together. So there were there were two kinds of migration from India during colonial times. Soon after colonialism became established, large swathes of the Indian countryside, the rural agricultural countryside, began to become very pauperized through the new tax. Basically, colonial capitalism plunged the Indian rural areas into such pauperization that whole communities began to experience cycles of famines. You have heard about some of the famous famines. In recent times, many people have talked about the Bengal famine, where 4 million people died. These were all man-made famines instigated by the colonial regime there. People don't know about these things, but at various times. So there were whole areas that would experience a huge famine. And the poor peasants, ordinary peasants will become poor peasants. The poor peasants will become landless, pauperized landless people. And then they won't have anywhere to go. So then the British, in 1833, slavery was abolished in the Caribbean islands and in Guyana and all those places. So they need, the freed slaves were not going to go back to work in the same plantations. So they needed labor for those plantations. So they brought large swathes of Indians as what they call indentured labor. It's just another name for slavery, I think, because those people went there and they never went back to India. They just died there in abject poverty, large numbers of them. And they went to the Caribbean islands, to Guyana, to Fiji, to Malaysia, Burma, to South Africa. Many of them came to build and service the tea plantations, coffee and tea plantations in my country, in Sri Lanka. So basically, they were just used as cheap labor who would just work to death, basically. That was one kind of migration. Then there was also another kind of migration where in colonial countries, there was always be the sort of a burgeoning bourgeois class or business class. Not necessarily bourgeois class, a mercantilist class in India, for instance, who were at the tip, at the cusp of developing into a proper bourgeois class, or they had aspirations. They were clamoring. They were clamoring for greater rights, greater accommodation by the colonial regime. They would usually be upper class or upper caste in those areas. So they also, this happened in Sri Lanka as well. But Sri Lankans did not go to East Africa. Sri Lankans went to Malaysia, Burma, Singapore, those places too. So these people were also migrated with the colonial administration. And they would go there and work there as sort of junior sub-agents of the colonial administration between the local population and the colonial administration. So basically, as subcontractors, as traders, many of them traders, subcontractors, junior civil servants, etc. And of course, they in East Africa, they had no interaction with the local African population, who because of their position and what the purpose for which they had been brought there, they remained separate from the local African population. And they imbibed the racism of their colonial masters. And of course, this was all fed back. So there is a historic phenomenon of anti-African racism within South Asian communities. It's there amongst all of them. And this, of course, was engendered during the colonial period, is my surmise. So, informed by the colonial governments. So though a section of those people also came to the UK, they migrated to UK. Well, they came here as stateless refugees when they were made to leave, forcibly enforced, deportations from Uganda mainly. And they had to come here as stateless refugees. They were basically entrepreneurial. They were very different from the working class Indians and Afro-Caribbeans and Africans who came here. So they are very, ideologically, their class positions are different ideologically also. So they had different interests and aspirations. For instance, Preeti Patel comes from that community.
So, right, if you mention that name on the show, Dave is going to explode. So it's happened, Dave. Calm down.
And what is very interesting is, and in the diaspora, we are not homogeneous community, none of us, and we have our own class hierarchies within our own communities, what has happened is we also the professional entrepreneurial classes amongst us are more conservative and more right-wing, and they are not likely to participate in working class struggles. They are not likely to come onto the street to participate in anti-racist struggles either. So our experiences are very different. And the more conservative amongst us, especially these culture wallahs, as I call them, they also, what they do is in the diaspora, they pickle their cultural experiences. For instance, I have been here 30 years in my own community. If I go back to Sri Lanka now and go back to the Tamil community, they have moved on. But the Tamils here have kind of lived in the past. They live a life that's like 30 years ago. And they also, we call it pickling their cultural life. They pickle it and they keep it like that. And not only have they not moved on, they also invent and reinvent and invent new cultural traditions to practice culture in the most self-conscious way. I mean, you know, back home, I wouldn't be getting up in the morning and saying, oh, I'm a Tamil, you know, I speak Tamil, I eat this, I do this on this day. And life goes on, basically. But here, it's very, and you know, all this multiculturalism is also, all of these kind of stimulate some of these tendencies as well. I'm not against culture. I love us to celebrate our culture. But you can see how it, these things can be taken to the excess and to the detriment of other aspects of our identities, such as class, you know, etc. So the upper class Indians, particularly Indians, they have, there's also, of course, another huge factor that is caste, because in the subcontinent, we have something called caste, which is an apartheid system of human beings, where people are divided into caste by birth and they are kept separate from each other. You know, there is untouchability, etc. Marriages are, you cannot marry across caste, etc. All kinds of, I mean, you know, it's too much to go into in this interview, but there is something called caste. And all of that, all those sort of, you know, backward, I would say, aspects of our culture is kind of sometimes emphasized here even more to a great extent. And so what happens is these, they are also constantly in linked to life back home. They are inspired, they go back there, they support their relatives, there is constant traffic, and you know, they read the Indian newspapers, etc. So the current BJP government in India is a Hindu fascist government. The BJP came out of the womb of the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is a Hindu fascist organization that was established in the 1925, and they modeled themselves on Mussolini's black shirts, and they are to this day they admire Hitler and Mussolini, and they avowedly they have stormtroopers, they train, and you know, these paramilitary cadres just like the Nazis did. And the BJP came out of this RSS. The RSS is 2 million strong. Tragically, India has been captured by this part, by these people. And they have an influential and a significant group of South Asians here who are beholden to them. So that all of that also contributes to this animosity or this condescension towards black people within the South Asian communities. This sympathy, particularly in the Indian community, I would say. And all of that accentuates the already existing anti-black racism within the South Asian communities, further accentuated by the sort of the political penetration by BJP elements, RSS elements. For instance, the Hindu Forum, UK, is an organization that has very strong links with the RSS in India. So, a lot of this is sort of circulated, all of this, you know, the political discourse is circulated through maybe temples and other cultural and religious organizations. So, in a way, how do we confront this challenge? How do we challenge these people and support the growth, the development of a progressive South Asian movement, which is with working class people, with people who suffer racial injustice? They themselves suffer, you know, they themselves suffer intense racism, particularly not the upper caste people, but people, because they are going out on the streets and, you know, working odd jobs, working, you know, low-wage jobs, etc. Such people experience racism all the time. But how do we make them, how do we get them to come out and show solidarity with black people in this country? who are in the front line of racial attacks and brutality. How do we do this? Is the big question now. So I hope I have been clear.
You've been extraordinarily clear. That is a really wonderful, concise history. And I have so many questions that really thank you for taking us through that. From the perspective of my culture, for what passes for culture, so much of that class division is something that I recognize from here. I recognize that kind of alienation from your own class, which I think is overall completely manufactured, completely designed, and over the last 30 years of class war, which is something Dave and myself talk about on this show a lot. This is a lot of things you've touched on that we discuss, perhaps not in the specifics of what you said, but certainly in the wider context. And you know, finding what this means, what equality groups mean to people who I never tire of pointing out to those around me. You might think there are racial differences between us, and how much those differences matter are debatable, but we are absolutely all in the same boat because we're all working people. You know, these East European immigrants that you're keen on shouting down and screaming about are just people who are doing exactly the same thing you and I do, and they're looking for a job. Now, the problem is, again, they've been demonized, and also, you know, unions haven't got our feet under the table as much as we should in their workplaces in order to make sure they are on decent terms and conditions, which you want to support because it benefits all of us. And the same thing goes for so much of the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, none of us want to be subjected to these appalling injustices, and they are just that, they are injustices.
I just wanted to say is that what we must make people understand is that, you know, race is not real. There is no racial division as such amongst us.
No, it's a construct.
We know scientifically, we know that race is not it's not material, the idea of race. But racism is material because racism ideologically was used, deployed as an ideological tool for colonial conquest and taken around, and it was, you know, it became a political weapon, and it was practiced by the colonial state all over the world again and again and again. And of course it was practiced in this country as well, because working class people were taken to far-flung countries to fight in those colonial wars, and many of them probably died in those wars and left to die, you know, in unmarked graves. But to feather the nest of those who became the new middle class, the new industrial class, that arose in Britain, basically. I mean, the English middle class, the English bourgeoisie, did do their, you know, capital accumulation from colonial conquest. So in that sense, racism, racial practice, has become material. While this is a very curious thing. So there are no racial differences between us as such, but there is as well, you know what I mean? Because ideologically, it's in our head. It's in our head. So how do we dissect this and break it down for people is the question.
I agree. And one of the things I struggle with, and maybe you could contemplate this question, I'll do my best to articulate it, is how much of the... So we've kind of talked about the planned way in which state and capitalism have manufactured these racial differences and driven us apart, etc., and tried to make people ashamed of their own working class roots, and have actually managed to make certain communities within the working class basically betray their own interests and their own people and all of this kind of stuff. But then I wonder if we're in the position now where so much of it isn't actually orchestrated, because it doesn't need to be, it just becomes automatic. You just naturally, too many people, for instance, I know around where I'm from, you know, you grow up in a predominantly white area, you adopt these notions of certain notions of racism, etc., certain notions of division, certain notions of not really thinking there's anything outside of the small realm that you're born into, and certainly cultural divisions, which is this idea of culture's never going to get any better than, say, 1970s sitcoms. And I say this sometimes, and it sounds like a joke, and I don't mind joking about it, but it's just amazing to me that there still seems to be arguments over the idea of programs that your granddad watched, or you or your dad watched, or your mum watched, and they're kind of fighting for these as if this is all the... And I often point out to people in this situation, I say, do you think possibly the idea you have this culture of yours in inverted commas, is dying, is because it's crap and nobody wants anything to do with it? And people would rather go on to new... better, more interesting, diverse things.
I want to touch on two issues as to, because what you're talking about is this sort of very thick, dense common sense that has evolved amongst the British people, the indigenous population at least, about the so-called aliens who are amongst them now. Once I was, one of my older kids had a young friend come and I was at a party with this young, with actually my niece's house. We were all at a party and she had some English friends around as well when we were all drinking. And this one young girl had got really drunk, very drunk. And she suddenly started blubbing and she said, it's terrible because you all have culture and we don't have any culture. So I was like astounded by the statement. So I said, don't be ridiculous. What do you mean? The saris, the samosas and this Bollywood dancing, are you worried about that? That's all nonsense. We are all the same. We all have very basic things. Culture, you know, so I had to give her a, you know, console and, you know, give her a little talk about what culture means. It's about everyday practice, basically. That's what culture is. And I said, I love to have a roast beef dinner on a Sunday, you know, because I loved, you know, just as you love curry, I also like to have, you know, English food. We make English food at home. So I said, this is not about that. So, you know, these cultural differences are also, you know, what is sad is that the commonalities, the universalities are not emphasized ever. So that is of experience, of human experience, which comes out in as culture, you know what I mean? I don't know, cultural practice. So that's one thing. The second thing about how this common sense about the so-called foreigners, I think became really hard on is the other big front line is immigration. I think it's the way the whole question of immigration has been played by different political parties in this country. And I will say, you know, I was working in the field of immigration for quite some years. And even during New Labour's time, you know, of course, the Tories have always used immigration as a tool to instill fear into the hearts of the indigenous population, saying that their culture is eroding, we are going to be swarmed, all of that. So obviously, ordinary people develop all kinds of phobias and fears. You see, when you see an outsider, if there is immediately a curiosity, but at the same time, a fear. That happens anywhere in the world. But when the state gives that legitimacy, and that process is powered by state power, then it assumes a different, it becomes a different phenomenon. It assumes a different weight. So that is what happens here when the state is a racist state and deploys these ideas into the body politic. Then, of course, these ideas become credible. Now, even under the Labour Party, that has happened. You know, we lived through terrible statements on immigration by successive home secretaries during New Labour time. In fact, you know, they didn't do anything to swing the discourse back towards the left, towards, you know, accepting immigration in any way at all. It stayed at that level, at the level the Tories had left it. So politicians and community leaders everywhere, the media, they all play a big role in inventing these, you know, in stitching together, knitting together this common sense amongst the people about immigrants coming here. I think it was one of the Home Secretaries during New Labour, what's her name? She was in Hornsey and Woodbreen, I've now forgotten her name. She said that she went to a chamber of commerce. She made this announcement. She was at this conference run by the chamber of, I know, British, some industry leaders. Mm. And we want immigration. We want the good immigrants. We want the good immigrants. They want the good and productive immigrant. I mean, you know, what does that mean? What does that mean? They want tech engineers and they want doctors and they want, you know, qualified people. But if people who are cleaners and who run the railways and, you know, repair the whatever or run restaurants and all that are not allowed to come here, then London will come to a standstill. So people come here because of a certain demand, labor shortages and demand in the labor market. That's why they come here. But then that is interpreted, that is politically used against them by these political parties. I blame the political parties and no one else. The political parties also control the messaging to the media, the political parties. And then, of course, the Tories are terrible at this. But unfortunately, Labour has followed suit, basically. During New Labour times, New Labour years, it was the same. And it hasn't really, really changed. It hasn't really changed. So what do you do?
No, absolutely. That was where they were heading. But one of the things we've talked about on the show quite a bit during this period of time with the terrible coronavirus situation is how many people within the NHS, for instance, have literally given their lives. Some of whom were retired have gone back, and so many of them were immigrants. And what I say to so many people, you know, immigrants and non-white immigrants too, and I say to people who raise this, I say, you know, these people have died protecting you and me. So what else does integration look like to you? How much more integrated did you imagine these, by your standards, do these people have to become, pardon the term, for you to go, oh yeah, actually, I accept this person in some way as British. And by the way, that's for the people I'm talking to. That's an entirely rhetorical question. I don't give a shit what they think. I'm just using it as a point. Completely. And New Labour sought to change. In fact, if anything, under people like Blunkett, they were as racist as the Tories.
Many of them. You know, the Lord Basham had said in the House of Lords in a more recent debate. That hostile environment, that phrase was originally coined by Alan Johnson. I know that Alan Johnson might have come from your union.
Don't mention that today. Thank you. Carry on. No, I'm only joking.
I mean, you know, he was right wing on immigration. I'm sorry. He was right wing. Phil Wallace, that Beverly Hughes or whoever, all those people. All of them, my God, David Blunkett, they were all terrible. And it's really, oh my God. That's why I couldn't join the Labour Party until 2015.
But I was exactly the same. Again, this is another wonderful thing me and Dave talk about as a 1990s. I deeply hate the 1990s, whereas he often plays songs on the show just to wind me up. There's a lot of things.
Can I just say one last thing?
Sure, jump in.
What's the people? They blame the people, saying that they're all racist. All these people are racist.
Yeah.
Yes, they have racist views. Yes, I agree. I agree they have racist views, many of them. And I know that, while I was on one of these Facebook sites, some black people, you know, I don't know them from Adam because we are all chatting across Facebook. They were saying, after the 2019 election, Labour defeat, they were saying that it was very uncomfortable for them to live in the North after Brexit, after the Brexit decision, because they were, you know, because large swathes of previously Labour supporting constituencies had voted to leave, and race was definitely one of the issues, or race, or you know. Aliens coming here, outsiders coming here was definitely one of the main issues. And then, of course, what happens is, so there is right across the country a view that there is too much immigration, too much immigrants here. Then what happens is the unions are also do not give leadership. I'm sorry. Some of the bigger unions, they don't give enough sufficient leadership. They they feel that they can't, they say, well, our members don't like it. So they pussyfoot around the immigration debate. I sometimes feel that they don't come clean on immigration, in the sense they don't recognize and openly state how beneficial immigration is to this country. And I don't want to only talk about immigration on the basis of benefit. It is also about racial justice. And, you know, immigrants here, this kind of discourse should not carry on simply because we want to be fair and even-handed and treat immigrants here who have settled and become British as British people, completely embrace them and accept them. And that cannot happen unless business leaders, political parties, union leaders, everybody, all the leadership figures, the media, they all say that it is okay to have migrants in this country. And that is a very important issue, I think.
All I can say is thank you. Unfortunately, we have to leave it there for this week. I hope we will certainly speak again in the future. But that has been an extremely engaging and enlightening conversation that we've had this week. So Nirmala, thank you so much for being on All the Rage. You're greatly appreciated, and I hope to speak to you again soon.
All the Rage with John Bowd on www.tracksfm.org.